Hi, I'm Dr. Julia Sigwart, and you're listening to Weird Species, an original podcast by Senckenberg. Here we tell stories about fascinating species from every corner of the world. It might be an animal or a plant. It might be tiny or large, super well-known or newly discovered. In each episode, I talk to an expert about their favorite species, and I always hear something I'd never heard of before. Welcome to another episode of Weird Species. It's my absolute pleasure today to introduce my friend and guest, Dr. Christopher Smith. You're the head of our MESL department, which I think deserves a little bit of explanation. Could you maybe tell everybody how important MESL is and why we have a whole department for it?
Certainly. So MESL is a site, a fossil site that goes back about 48 million years, and it represents an ancient Mar Lake. And I confess, I studied geology, and for some reason the term Mar Lake did not come up in my studies. But a Mar Lake is sort of like a volcanic crater lake that is actually extremely common. And this one's about 48 million years old, so it goes back to a time called the Eocene, when there was a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere than there is today. And so temperatures were a lot warmer, and this ancient lake here preserves fossils of such extraordinary quality that it was put on the list of UNESCO World Heritage Sites. And it offers really unique insight into what life was like under these kinds of climatic conditions.
It's something like, you know, maybe the world that we're heading toward now. But very importantly, this lake, the ancient lake at MESL, where is it? It's near us here in Germany, right?
It is very close to us, in fact, about 20 kilometers south of here, very close next to the Rhine River flowing north. That's where MESL is, yeah.
So we went there, some of my colleagues from our malacology department. The mollusks had a summer trip to the MESL pit and got a special private tour, which was just absolutely fabulous. There's actually very few mollusk fossils from MESL.
Did you get to find any?
No. They did get some out to show us as a special treat, but the rest of the fossils were just absolutely fabulous. Beautiful insects with all of the colors still preserved, and of course, I guess the stars of the show are the reptiles.
For me, certainly.
There's a giant crocodile. I remember them making a big fuss about how big is the biggest crocodile?
Oh, maybe 3 meters, a bit longer, and perhaps more astonishing is the fact that the largest species of crocodile from MESL is not the kind of typical crocodile that you would imagine, you know, like a salty hanging around in a little billabong in Australia, but rather a terrestrial crocodile with hooves.
What?
So a kind of crocodile that's going to run through the forest after you.
That's awesome. I mean, you and I, you know, both grew up in the U.S., so we're kind of used to the idea that there might be alligators in, you know, parts of the country, which is something I think that really blows the minds of Europeans, but a crocodile with hooves stomping across Germany. That's fantastic. I'm glad they're not here.
Their teeth were actually really cool. They're flattened and elongated and recurved, very much like theropod dinosaur teeth. So
that's quite scary. Yeah. Okay, and I remember when I first started working in Senckenberg, I heard a story from you about a fossil that you were working on at the time, which was several fossils in one. So can you share that with everybody, because it's a fabulous, fabulous fossil.
That is one of the really cool fossils from MESL, I have to say. So they dug up this little snake. It might be a meter long, but you would hardly guess it because it's coiled up. It looks just like a pretzel, in fact. I was thinking maybe we should get some bakery to sponsor our excavations there at MESL, and that could be the mascot. So the snake's about a meter long. You wouldn't guess it because it's so coiled up. But when you look really closely at it, you find there's something in the stomach. And you know that it's in the stomach because, first of all, it's not supremely digested. And second of all, you can see that it's between the ribs of the left and the right side of the snake. And this animal inside it is a lizard. And then when you look more closely inside the lizard, you find in its stomach this shimmering color that you mentioned earlier, the coloration of the insects. And it's an insect inside of the belly of the lizard. And so we have this we have this three linked trophic chain in one single specimen.
That's amazing. It's a whole ecosystem just in one slab.
Yeah. Ah.
So tell me, how did you come to be here working on these fossils and all of the other wonderful things that you do in Senckenberg? You've had quite a journey.
Serendipity. As a graduate student, I wanted to take a German course because there's so much old literature written in German, detailed anatomy and everything else, and I wanted to be able to read that and not just cite it. So
it's true. I went through the same thing during my PhD. Like, one of my great goals in my PhD was to do something that hadn't been done by Ludwig Plater in 1901.
Nice. Yeah, so I wanted to take a German course. Actually, I don't want to diverge too much, but I wanted to take the German course, and my doctoral advisor told me at the time, that's a terrible idea. And so I was like, well, okay, I guess I won't do it. And then we had our qualifying exams, and I went through that, and there was no problem. And I said, now I want to take that course. So I did. And then I ended up getting the opportunity to come over to Germany, and I was down in Karlsruhe for a while. And I also came up here to Senckenberg to look at some of the Messel fossils. And yeah, a few years later, a position opened up, and I applied for it, and here I am.
Fantastic. Yeah, yeah. We have some academic overlap from even earlier in your career, if I remember. So where did you do your undergrad? And what better group of organisms were you studying for your undergraduate thesis? Tell our listeners.
Yeah, I did my undergraduate degree at Berkeley. And there I was very happy to be in the lab of Dave Lindberg, working with one of his former graduate students, Rob Guralnik, who has certainly gone on to his own career right now.
And these are both, you know, great malacologists and, you know, colleagues and friends of mine, you know, who still work on mollusks.
They have not, they're not apostates like me. But yeah, so that was really cool. I just wanted to do some research. I was technically in geology at the time, like I said, but I was interested in paleontology, and Rob had a project that he was working on and wanted, that's how it all started, actually. There was a morphological character matrix on patella gastropods, on limpets, and I was supposed to go through and then double check a number of the scorings, and, you know, are there eyes present and these sorts of things. And eventually I came around to the muscles and the cartilages in the mouth, and then we sort of got into more of the research side of that and came out with I think a pretty nice paper on how limpets eat.
Limpets eat many different things. You know, there's many different specialized feeding modes among the limpets. They also have cool jaws. It's not just these reptile newcomers. Fantastic. Well, I guess it's okay. You know, it's good that you know, people learn their grounding in real science working on invertebrates before they, you know, move on to other groups of organisms. So. But what's your favorite species?
Well, there are a great number of really cool species, but I guess if I had to pick one, it would probably be the Gila monster, Heloderma suspectum.
So this is an American lizard, a good American or Mexican-American, North American lizard. I know a little bit about the Gila monster because my father grew up in Arizona. The Southwest fauna, you know, featured, you know, in our sort of family folklore. My dad is a runner. He ran long distance track. And so his nickname when he went on to university was Roadrunner, because he was the kid from Arizona that ran track.
He never stepped on a Gila monster, I guess.
I don't think he probably did. No. Since I don't have a story about some terrible, terrible experience that would come from that. So what would happen if you were so foolish as to step on a Gila monster?
Well, he would probably have been in a lot of pain. I've certainly never been bitten by a Gila monster. In fact, I've never had one as a pet. There's some people who keep them as pets or try to breed them. I don't have enough testosterone for that, but they're pretty chill animals by reputation. But unpredictable. And if you do get bitten, the pain is described as, well, it's indescribable, exceedingly painful. I mean, there's a large number of peptides that they have in their venom, and their bite is just incredibly powerful. I mean, I can show you a cast here of what the head of these things look like, and just the jaw closing muscles are just extraordinary, and they latch on and they do not let go. I heard the story one time of a guy who was, you know, cleaning out the terrarium of his Gila monster, and he did what he would normally do, and just wants to clean one side, so he grabs on the thing's tail and pulls it to the other side. But they have shortened tails, and so he just kind of wrapped around in a U shape this time, latched onto his thumb and wouldn't let go. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to hurt the animal. It was his pet, right? So he drove to the hospital with a Gila monster dangling from his thumb, and they spent several hours trying to coax this thing to let go.
Ouch. Okay. There's several lessons I think that we can all learn from that. but these animals, they're not that big. So when we, I think when people think of lizard and monster, they're thinking of like, you know, the giant Komodo dragon, you know, something like that. But even though almost everything is bigger in North America, actually the Gila monster is not that big an animal. Well, they're what, like 50 centimeters?
Yeah, that's probably about right, 50, 60, certainly under a kilogram. They're substantial animals, but they're not giants. You're right, the term monster is a little confusing if you've never seen one before. Yeah.
So something that you could like keep in your house. It's not like the dragon that you have to like put a leash on and take it for walkies.
No, it'd be different if you had a North American alligator, for instance, in your
house. Right. No, also not sensible.
Not sensible.
No. Okay. So for the Gila monster, I think there's also a really fun story in its name. So Geloderma suspectum. So do you remember the story of the name suspectum?
No, I don't.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Have you looked this up? Please tell me.
So, Geloderma suspectum.
It's named by Cope, right?
Don't remember. Believe you. That's probably right. But the name suspectum was given because, of course, like many species that are named by taxonomists, even today, it was named from preserved specimens. So no one had seen this animal alive who was involved in naming it. And the only similar thing that they knew about was the Mexican bearded dragon, which I think is probably not all that closely related. I mean, it looks very different to me. I don't know. But they saw the strange jaw and the venom glands, or I think it's got grooves in the mouth or something. There's some structure of the jaw that shows how incredibly venomous this animal is. And so whoever was naming it said, yeah, I'm pretty sure this is different. I'm pretty sure this thing is very venomous and very different and very strange. And so that was the name, suspectum. Suspect that this thing is venomous and interesting and different.
I'm going to have to read, I confess I've never read the original description. I am going to have to do that now.
Yeah, it's just a lovely etymological story, you know, one of these like little, you know, stories of the history that's kind of buried in the name.
The Mexican species, well, I think now it's been split into a couple of them, but the Mexican species is Geloderma horridum, which tells you something about how the herpetologists viewed these things.
But the horridum is not the super venomous one.
I don't know how their venom compares. Both have substantial venom glands in their lower jaw and, as you said, also grooves in their teeth in order to allow this venom to enter the prey.
Cool. Yeah, very effective. Great. So what did you bring along? You brought me a prop.
Oh, I brought on a couple of things here. Okay. First of all, just a cast of the head.
The plastic head of a Gila monster.
You can see how massive these jaws are. I mean, look at these muscles here.
They're very cute, though. They've got their studded skin. They look like they've got their leathers on, you know. But they're not so big. They're like, you know, size of a cat. So it's exactly the kind of lizard that, you know, could make a really nice house pet if it wasn't prone to causing you, you know, deadly pain.
They're absolutely fascinating animals. Low species diversity, there are them and their relatives, they're they are not and have never been particularly diverse, but the lineage goes back 100 million years.
Fantastic.
They've been
just
around
doing
forever,
what they do.
Doing what they do. And the thing is, they're highly specialized animals. I mean, sometimes you think of specialists as maybe that promotes diversity, right? By being able to partition the environment more finely. On the other hand, maybe being a specialist might cause you a premature extinction because you get so specialized, the environment changes, and then what do? You can't adapt quickly enough.
Living in a desert is not easy. Like, this is a difficult life under the best of circumstances.
And yet these things are hanging around, getting more and more specialized as time goes by. We know the whole lineage that ended up migrating over to Europe at one time. We know them from Mesa that we just talked about. We have a whole skeleton. And yeah, we can see how these things just become more specialized over time and just kind of hanging on.
So when you say they're specialized, what makes them specialized? What is it that that's so specific that we see in their anatomy or their behavior or, I don't know, their moods or what?
Various things. They're very slow. They have a very low basal metabolic rate.
So they don't need to eat very much.
They don't need to eat very much. Low activity. And yet, contrary-wise, they have one of the highest aerobic capacities that has ever been measured. That is, normally, they don't use a lot of oxygen. But if they need to, they can use incredible amounts of oxygen in their muscles.
So they go from 0 to 100 just in a very, very short space of time if they need to run or...
And when it comes to the kind of movement that they have, it's not the kind of movement where they're going to get up and run after you or chase down prey. They're used in these combat rituals between the males. So the males, they have their little burrows, they kind of stick around. But during the breeding season, the males will go and start looking for the females. And if they encounter other males, they might get into a little conflict, a wrestling match. And that can go on for hours until the one finally is defeated and then kind of slinks away. And then
So they do nothing all year. And then they just go looking for a fight and like get into a boxing match.
Exactly. There was a population in Mexico that was recorded as being active for 20 hours per month. Per month. Other than that, they're just spending most of their time hanging around in their burrow unless they get hungry or they want to go look for a mate.
That's fantastic. I mean, I remember having this conversation with a behavioral ecologist many, many years ago who said the problem really with a lot of our study of animal behavior is that everyone's really focused on the three Fs. So feeding, fighting, and looking for mates. And he said, but actually, you know, if you think about animals, if you watch an animal, even us, or, you know, anything, like watch a bird outside your window, watch your goldfish in its bowl, like what's it doing most of the time?
Not those three things.
Just hanging out. The problem with our study of trying to understand the motivation for, you know, any kind of the behavior, the, you know, sort of daily energy budget of animals is that you're not accounting for the fact that 90% of their time is just hanging out. Yeah. And so this is like an extreme version of that. Gila monsters.
Absolutely right.
Just hanging out.
Further things. Of course, they're highly venomous. For a long time, it was considered those are thought to be the only really venomous lizards. Yeah, our understanding of what venom is in lizards has been maybe updated in the last couple of decades through some
So the
some
venom part is actually not so specialized then?
Well, it is certainly the most complicated of the venoms amongst any lizards. And they do have these really enlarged venom glands. But
so they're really, really into it.
They're really, really into it. And yet, what do they eat? They eat
whatever they
obligate
can.
Nest predators. They eat eggs and nestlings almost exclusively.
So like recently hatched and about to hatch of birds,
lizards, mammals, whatever they can find.
As long as it comes in like tasty snack baby form.
Correct.
Huh.
And they're not using their poison to subdue
these
animals either then. So it's probably then more related to defense. The coloration is strange, and the one time, you know, these red and white stripes kind of say, here I am. Mm-hmm. And
they've got spots on them too. Like, they've got beautiful color patterns sometimes. Like,
some of them
yellow
have
yellow spots, red stripes. And they're variable, right? And they even change over
there. Quite variable between populations, mm-hmm. absolutely. And on the one hand, it seems to say, here I am. And then on the other hand, given some of the environments that they live in, may actually be kind of cryptic the environment that if you're living in these red rock environments.
Yeah. Being red doesn't necessarily signal some kind of aposomatic, like, I'm poisonous. It could actually be that you just live somewhere red and stripy.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. So very specialized venom, very specialized food, but not a specialized venom that helps you get the specialized food.
Right.
Cool. I think this is a lovely example of how much we depend on the storytelling in evolution, as if it's, you know, honing this perfect, perfectly adapted beast, but actually it doesn't work that way at all. And so we end up with these like, kind of mismatches and misfires, because really we know that evolution is just, you know, like, that was good enough.
One of my favorite sayings, I think, is attributed to this guy named Leslie Orgel, who said, evolution is smarter than you are.
Yeah. And usually the way to be smart about winning is to just do what's necessary.
Do what's necessary. That's absolutely right.
You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to, like, kind of predict the future or be the best you that you could. You just have to be good enough.
That's right.
Okay, so I don't think I've ever seen a Gila monster alive in the wild. I've seen them like in zoos or possibly in a disreputable pet shop. but I don't think I've ever seen one in the wild. I've been in that region not actually very much, although the deserts, the Sonora Desert, is just absolutely like a thrilling moonscape. Oh my God, like nothing on earth. Fabulous deserts. Have you been able to see these things alive in the wild?
I have also been in the Sonora Desert, and I fully share your view of its indescribable beauty, and I have never seen one in the wild.
Because they're just sitting there being sleepy. Yeah.
I did have a permit one time to collect any corpses of them if I should find one, because, you know, sometimes things get run over and
roadkill,
it would be a shame.
In my book, roadkill fully counts as wildlife spotting.
Ah, unfortunately, that didn't work out either. So.
Not a shame.
Or maybe fortunately for the Gila monster.
Yeah. This is nice when they, when they're not getting hit by cars. Yeah. It's a better world. A few years ago, I was visiting a museum which unfortunately had a relatively rapidly increasing number of specimens of pangolins. And the good news was that the pangolins were doing better, but the bad news was that they kept getting hit by cars.
Oh! That's better than what I thought you were going to say, which is something about getting specimens that had been imported through
the airport. Yes, those also the ones that are getting seized by customs for increasing recognition of CITES violations. Yeah, always to protect species that are a little bit too late. We'd much rather that they just don't get hit by poachers or cars. That would be a better world.
So I've actually worked rather closely with a guy up in Aslar, as a Jochen Schwandt, who breeds those. In fact, he wrote the book on them recently, and they're really, really awesome animals.
Oh, that's great. So is there a large German population of Gila monsters?
Not a large one, but there's a small and contained one.
Good. The way they should be.
We're actually doing some dietary experimentation on them, trying to see what you could tell about their diets from what they get to eat. So,
Yeah, okay. Best not to dwell on like how you get your hatchlings and what types of hatchlings you're feeding to them. But as a swift divergence, you have a hatchling of your own, so this is not one that's threatened by Gila monsters, is it?
No, given his size, I mean, he's 3 years old, and we buy clothes for five-year-olds. It's more likely that he's going to be the danger for everything around him.
Okay, well, not to cast aspersions on your son and his ability to take care of reptiles. You mentioned, so there's a few Gila monsters alive in Germany. That's super cool. And I think it's important that, you know, for animals that can be, you know, bred in captivity and that are living in environments that are so vulnerable and threatened and unique, it's really wonderful to have that community of hobbyists and, you know, the people who are really passionate about the species, who can be very involved and very helpful with conservation efforts and even research efforts.
I think you're absolutely right about that. They play an underappreciated role in this. There are plenty of hobbyists who are not in it for the money, but rather for the sake of conservation.
Yeah, they love and the species.
They love the species. And yeah, sometimes you get rare species. Another good example, part of the same larger group of lizards, there are things like the Chinese crocodile lizard, Chinosaurus crocodilurus, or Lanthanotus borneensis, the earless monitor lizard. And there are, another friend of mine, Michael Solveig, is involved in the breeding of these animals and has also written the books about how to do that. And given how small the populations are in the wild, if you can learn to breed them outside the wild, as he has, and then you can use this information then to increase the stocks of these animals mm-hmm. and to contribute to species conservation.
Well, and also just preserving the genetic diversity too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so important. So how much of your work is actually on, we've been talking about living species, but you're a paleontologist, really, and you said your background was in geology. So how much of your own research is with living species or extinct fossil species?
Right, fair question. I am not a herpetologist, and I do not do so much work with living species. I am principally a paleontologist. It's important to understand the living species as much as possible. I mean, I've gone down to the Caribbean to do some collecting just because I wanted to understand what these modern environments are like. And you can talk about, this lineage that we find in the site, you know, it's sort of a tropical lineage, but until you really it's hard to understand how these animals actually live until you've seen it yourself.
Like you were saying, the Gila monsters, you know, they go into burrows, which of course is a very natural way to survive in a desert environment that's very hot, very arid, and, you know, of course these are animals that depend, you know, very much on the sun and the temperature to regulate their own body temperature. But, you know, sometimes too hot is too hot. It's nice to have some nice, cool underground shade to go into. But even the really simple thing like knowing what modern animal burrows look like is so important to understand the context, the burial context, and the taphonomic context for fossils.
Absolutely. If you want to understand, I mean, fundamentally, I'm interested in two different things in my research. On the one hand, I want to be able to understand the roots of things. I like the roots of things. I like to understand where things come from. And I want to be able to use fossils to try to explain biogeographically, morphologically, anatomically, how the species that we see alive today, these really awesome things we see around us, how they came to be. And on the other hand, one can sort of turn the question around and ask not how did environment influence the evolution of these species, but rather how can we say something about ancient environments using the composition of these fossils in our assemblages? And so I kind of work in both directions. It's sometimes a very complicated endeavor. We've talked a bit about Messel, and Messel is great. These complete skeletons, there's no other place on Earth, few other places on Earth where you can go and see these things, certainly not from this time period.
But the amazing thing about Messel is also just the density of fossils. I mean, I think what's really important is that, you know, you're talking about trying to reconstruct past environments, and the biggest challenge is that so much is lost, you know? It's not normal to have a complete lake system where literally every tiny insect and every leaf is completely preserved. Normally we find fossils in relative isolation, you know, lucky events here and there. And
or if you do have the kind of accumulation which brings fossils together, it may pertain to one part of the ecosystem. You might have a lot of plants, you know, leaf beds or some insects thrown in there. Then you're probably not going to have vertebrates in there as well. Or you may have bone accumulation because there was some predator sitting there, I don't know, producing scat or owl pellets or something. But then you don't have the plants or the insects. And in Messel, you have everything.
Yeah, so there's not as much of a taphonomic filter that you get on normal fossil assemblages. So yeah. We really have this sort of beautiful reconstructions of Messel as, you know, this complete ecosystem, this sort of location out of time.
Exactly right. Yeah, in other localities, it's hard to understand how unique Messel is unless you've worked in some of these other localities. Because you'll go to some, I mean, imagine you had this little corner here and there was a, I don't know, population of birds who were living in the trees there and they're spitting up their little pellets and you have this accumulation of little bones. Say there were 20 species living in this area and you get all of these tiny little isolated broken fragments. It's like if you took, say, 500 skeletons from an unknown number of species and stomped on them all and then pulled out 5% of the pieces and said, how many species were there and what did they look like and who are they related to?
Yeah. And please build me a statistical model that makes this very convincing so I can get it into a good journal.
That is the only way that it can be done, but it can be done.
Yeah.
That being said, if you can go to a place like Messel, you don't have to do it.
Yes. But even as I said, the number of fossils in Messel, I remember the tour guide who was very kind to take us around was saying, you know, a normal fossil locality has, you know, this number of fossils per year or per kilo of rock or per some unit, and comparing that to Messel, it's dramatically higher. Can you put that in context? Otherwise, we can cut this part.
I'm happy to talk about this. Honestly, this is frequently said. I'm not yet convinced that that's the case.
Oh, that's interesting.
We recently did a study.
Controversial.
Controversial. We recently did a study on the bats of Messel. Mm-hmm. And so, as you said, awesome. We know there are tons of fossils in Messel. This much is clear. In our collection here at Zankenberg, we have 35,000 specimens of plants and 21,000 specimens of insects and 5,000 some odd vertebrates. There are a lot of fossils in Messel, but
and we don't even have all of it because it's shared between the museum that's actually based at the World Heritage Site, and other regional museums also have material, and museums all over the world have fossils from Messel.
We've been recently trying to compile that all. We got 30 different public institutions that hold Messel fossils. So they're scattered and they're very numerous. This much is clear. But are they too numerous to explain by chance processes? Like, how many fossils do you expect to form in a little lake every year? And so we did this little study of bats. I was looking. Bats are really interesting because there are a lot of them at Messel. I don't know. We have 530 or so fossil bats.
That's a lot of
Messel.
Fossil bats.
That's a lot of fossil bats. And one of the arguments that was always brought up about why there are so many fossils there. They said, oh, there's so many flying animals, bats and birds. And so there must have been these layers of CO2 that developed over this volcanic lake. And maybe the animals
like
are flying
in the lake
into
water. Or, oh, no, over the water.
Well, certainly, like you say, there's a lot of CO2 that's dissolved in the water as a result of decay processes. And there are reasons to think that at times that might have been then released into the atmosphere. Okay. But also as a result of maybe volcanic processes, you might have releases of volcanic gases. And CO2 is heavier than air. It's going to accumulate over the water, at least if there's no wind. And if you have these animals flying through these clouds of CO2.
It's like a toxic lake. And then they just like fall out of the sky and turn into fossils.
Right. And this is a really interesting idea. There are examples of modern lakes like Lake Nyos in Cameroon, 1986 it was, I think. You had this burped out a bunch of CO2
and
other
the birds
gases.
Fell out of the sky.
They never got to say how many birds died, but it did kill 1,700 people and lots of cattle.
Oh, my.
So
okay, that's worse.
Comparison to Messel, we then tried to estimate how many. So we have 500 specimens, but how many of them, how many specimens per year are we talking about?
Right, because fossil assemblages are always, you know, sort of accumulated over much longer spans of time than we normally think about. It's not just one, you know, everyone, I think, has this popular image of the end Cretaceous meteorite impact that killed off the Ammonites and also those dinosaur thingies that you keep going on about. And so this was clearly like a fairly instantaneous event, and we have a very detailed reconstruction of how that played out over, you know, even hours or days or years or decades. But that's it. Like, actually, most of the impact is on the scale of decades or centuries, even for an impact like that. And then a site like Messel, like, what's the time span that we're talking about?
Right. So the Oil shale, as it's called, that's this kind of rock where we find most of the fossils in, was deposited over a course of, I don't know, maybe 700,000 years, maybe a million years, depending on whose reckoning you're talking about, and depending on whether and how much oil shale was sitting on top that's already been completely removed. But we're talking about several hundred thousand years in any case.
Okay, for 500 bats.
Well, we're not, of course, excavating in throughout all of this profile, though.
Okay.
We have these tiny little...
Yeah, the detailed pits that get taken apart layer by layer by many dedicated students of paleontology and their meticulous work in the hot summers.
Exactly right. And when you try to make an estimate then of how many of them are died per year, we come up with about 6 to 9 per year.
Okay.
So, for the whole lake. Mm-hmm. So... this is a number which is comparable to the number of bats that you can find in a swimming pool.
Okay.
And so, and there's no, with possibly one exception, there's no evidence for any horizons where you find lots of...
Sudden death assemblage.
Right.
But that's interesting because it means that you don't need to have some, you know, sort of semi-magical explanation about how this was a terrible death trap that, like, brought in all of these things to their doom. But it does show that the preservation potential in Messel is extraordinary because it means that everything that goes in is getting fossilized.
It's absolutely right. And that's, like you said earlier, the spectrum, I want to say the faunal spectrum, but that's not the right word because, of course, Messel has a lot more than just the fauna. The spectrum of life that we
total
find,
there's biodiversity.
Is amazing. We recently tried to calculate how many taxa have been described from Messel, and we come up with a number of 1,332.
Wow, more than 1,000.
More than 1,000. The number of biological species is probably lower because some of these things represent duplicates, like you have a pollen taxon and a leaf taxon.
Yeah.
Still, a very high diversity. And these are being deposited little by little. I mean, the yearly accumulation rate there is on the order of 0.15 millimeters per year, which sounds like it's very low, but... in fact, that's a relatively high accumulation rate for rock. And so we have a very, very detailed record of how this ecosystem looked like, how it changed, how the species interacted. That's really unparalleled for this time period.
Yeah. No, it's quite an extraordinary place to visit, I think. So the most famous thing about Messel, I have to ask you about this because this is what I always tell people, and I'm so happy to have this conversation with you because now I have different ways to explain Messel. But the thing that every biology student is familiar with is, of course, the little horses. But the little horses aren't important anymore. This is the problem. So in biology textbooks from when you and I were students, there was this beautiful sort of storytelling story about, you know, the evolution of the horse from little horses to big horses. And the little horses that we had the textbook drawings of were the little horses from Messel, but now we all know that that is not quite the linear progression that was presented in old textbooks, and the little horses are just little horses that aren't really on their path to any other bigger horses.
No, the story of horses is really fascinating, and I'm glad you brought that up because you mentioned my Berkeley days. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that I was doing when I was at Berkeley was working on some Eocene horses from North America. And these are not complete skeletons. It's not Messel, but the material is pretty nice. And so I was spending a lot of time trying to understand their teeth and how they were related to each other and how you could see the succession through time. Yeah, the earliest fossil horses were described, I think it was 1876, by Othniel Charles Marsh from Wyoming.
Ah, the famous dinosaur wars.
The famous dinosaur wars, exactly. And he recognized this little ankle bone as being like a horse ankle bone,
okay,
or a tapir ankle bone. And so that's why he called it Aeohippus, the dawn horse. In fact, there's a little sketch that they have there of when Thomas Henry Huxley visited Yale, mm-hmm, and visited Marsh. And there was a little sketch that Huxley drew of Eohomo riding on Eohippus.
Aww. You know,
little dawn man riding on dawn horse. Yeah.
Beginning of civilization.
The beginning of civilization.
Okay.
But these are some of the earliest horses that we know come from the very dawn of the Eocene. There was this event called the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. CO2 shot way up to, I don't know, 2,500 ppms or something like that over a very short period of time. And coincidental with this warming, suddenly these primitive tiny little horses appear in North America and then moving over into Europe at about the same time. And
this is right around the sort of Messel time, like this sort of 50 million year mark.
Exactly.
A little bit before Messel.
56 point something, mm-hmm. I think, is the latest date on this. But yeah, right, early Eocene, mm-hmm. part of this greenhouse world, exactly. And that's where most of horse evolution transpired. I mean, I do like to think back on these days and some of the work that I did on horses. I don't wish to pretend that I'm a horse specialist by any means, but most of horse evolution did transpire then in North America. And there was a great diversity of these things, and you can see how they progressively became more specialized and eating things like grass, and they start losing their toes and they get bigger and their teeth become more specialized. And of course, they inevitably migrated out of North America and visited a number of other places. But as I'm sure you know, what became of horses then, despite the fact that most of their evolutionary history transpired in North America, they eventually became completely extinct. Mm-hmm. And we have this image in our head, maybe, of these Native Americans on horseback, you know, shooting bows and arrows or something like that from this, these images from this time period back then. But
only after horses got reintroduced.
Only after they were reintroduced by Europeans during the colonization.
Yeah. Okay. But not the lizards. The lizards were there all along.
But the lizards were there all along. North America, of course, has its own very interesting history. You go back to the Eocene, this time period, and many of the lizards belong to groups that today are far more tropical in distribution. Things like galley wasps and, yes, Gila monster relatives.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. To wrap this up, so you have talked a lot about some travels that you've done here and there, but I know that most of us, most science gets done in the lab, not so much actually doing the excavation or doing the travel part. And this volumes of fossils that we have, especially from the Messel site, I'm sure you have enough for many careers and many lifetimes already here in the museum. So how often do you go to the Messel pit or to the site? That's my one question. And then my other question is, tell me about some recent travel that's not work-related at all, if you have any.
I get down to Messel, at least to the research station, probably once a month or so. I don't get to go out into the field very much to do any excavations. Mm. You say that's mm-hmm. regrettably yeah. a part of... perhaps the one reason I became a paleontologist is because I love being outside. Mm-hmm. I love being in the field. There's nothing more pleasant, the peace but also the stimulating intellectual atmosphere, because you're running around the entire time trying to understand the environment that's around you, and understanding these folds and how did the environment change through time, and where can I find the best fossils,
and seeing it through that different lens of trying to kind of look at the environment today, but looking through time to figure out what's there and past eras. I mean, it's hard even just to overcome urbanization, and like the Messel pit is a great example of that, because of course it was an active quarry. So the shape that it has now was shaped by humans, first as a quarry and then a little bit by paleontological excavation. And so trying to unpick all of these layers of human history and then geological history to really reconstruct what the world was like, in a time more than, 40, 50 million years ago. This is a really fun puzzle to try to unpick.
That's exactly what it is. It's a fun puzzle. Speaking of human modifications in the environment, perhaps the most human modified site that I've been at besides Messel was only the German word is occurring to me right now. Wurmenschenhöhle. A former cave that filled with hominin remains and things like that.
So some of these early human fossil or sites that are associated with early human
exactly.
fossils.
Exactly. So it's this site in Israel, and they were trying to expand the street and dynamiting the hillside while they were at it. But of course, they have to have an archaeologist there to mm-hmm. follow the report. And as soon as he saw this cave being blown up, he was like, well, stop the machines.
Archaeologists with their finger on the emergency stop button.
Exactly. And they'd only dynamited half the cave or so. So it turns out it's about 300,000 years old. And I don't know, is there quite a bit working on some of these lizards, of course, mm-hmm. and snakes from this time. And literally,
that's the interesting part.
Of course, we were trying to understand how the lizards and snakes would say something about the humans that the hominids that live there. But literally, 1.5 meters next to me all day long is the freeway and cars flying past you all day long.
Wow.
So that was...
That's a bit of a head wreck.
To
try to focus on the ancient time and block out the incredible noise of...
But some speleologist came by at some point and was saying he was on his way to go... Yeah, thank you. He was on his way to go see some other site, and I boldly asked if I could go with him because I just wanted to see what a real cave looks like.
An intact cave
that you can get inside
and get away from the noise.
So he did. He took me along, and it was at times very frightening being in so tight an opening at times, but it was really cool.
Are you claustrophobic?
No, not really. Even so... When you're going through a tiny little chute and you have the feeling that I can't hardly move. I can only move my arm, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, at least I had to consciously bring down.
Yeah, you have to relax
the level
your body.
Of adrenaline and say it's going to be okay. People have gone through here before.
Other you people have got too. Through here. I got this far, which means I can go back.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of caving. I love show caves. You know, so the ones that are open to the public and done with lights and tours, and you don't get to see the fauna. You don't get to see all of these great, troglodytic species, the wonderful blind insects and snails and, things like that.
Also vertebrates.
Okay, whatever. but you still, the geology, though, like to be able to be in show caves that are actually opened for tourists and to be able to experience the geology, I think is...
Pretty spectacular.
Yeah. Anyway, Christopher Smith, thank you so much for joining us on Weird Species. It's been a fun conversation. I learned a lot, and I hope we have you back again.
It's been a great pleasure, and I'll try to move on to the next species.
Excellent. One species at a time. So I'm Julia Sigwart, the host of Weird Species. You should subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and look out for new episodes.